And now we have the next speaker is Ross Emmett from Michigan State University. And he will focus more on Canada and the Hispanic or the Canada.
No,
the Canada. Canada. Okay.
It's yours.
To lighten and transition the time here to the last address, I thought I told Chris Burkett this morning that I would start off the following way. I am a professor in a large public university in America, and I am proud to be an American. But there's a catch. I am also a Canadian. And my being here today emerges out of that dual loyalty and out of the question of Canadian identity in the Americans and the Americas. And some of the same questions will come up that just were asked at the very end of the last presentation, but about the Canadian experience. But my Canadian experience is unique in that I was an American who then became a Canadian without giving up his Americanness and have returned to the United States. So I have a somewhat unusual starting point. Sam Gregg apparently yesterday wrote the following. I follow him on Facebook, so I saw this yesterday and grabbed it. It's quite possible, he says, for societies to be materially prosperous but culturally adrift. And that's precisely where the West finds itself today. Economically speaking, it remains extremely well off. Nevertheless, the West has rarely appeared more uncertain of itself and of the worth of its patrimony. I'm going to suggest that just as we have been discussing that comment would be true about the United States, I want to argue that it's even more true of Canada, or in Canada we see this with spades, as Americans would say, with lots more heaped on top. My talk's going to have three elements to it. I'm going to tell a little personal story. I'm going to reflect on a reflection about Canadian identity. And then I'm going to comment on the question of whether or not it's even possible to think about recovering a Canadian identity that's consistent with the kinds of themes that we have been talking about here today. So the personal story first. In the summer of 1981, I accepted my first academic job teaching business in a church-related liberal arts college near Vancouver, British Columbia. Being young and adventurous, we decided that we would drive from Virginia to Vancouver and use the opportunity to visit family along the East Coast before driving across, first across Maine from Mount Desert Island to the eastern boundary of Quebec, and then taking the Trans-Canada Highway from Quebec City to Vancouver. The Trans-Canada Highway, by the way, is a feature of Canadian identity. It's like a spine that unites the entire population, given that 80% of the Canadian population lives within 100 miles of the U.S. border, and the Trans-Canada Highway runs, in some cases, very close to the U.S. border. And only where larger cities are departs from that. The Trans-Canada Highway is a single highway that runs from St. John's, Newfoundland to Victoria, British Columbia, uniting the country. Back to the personal story. In New England, we spent a couple of days with each of my grandmothers, one who lives near Boston and the other one in the hills of New Hampshire near Lake Winnipesaukee. My father's mother is the one I want to speak about. She was a middle school history teacher in Saugus, Massachusetts, and in many ways, I think I owe my American love of America to her. When my father was young, she saved the local town's historic ironworks from the grasping hand of Henry Ford, who wanted it for Greenfield Village, not far from here, because it was the first ironworks in America. It was dilapidated and run down out of operation. She coordinated a community campaign that kept it from Ford's grasp by having it declared a National Historical Site and bringing it the resources to bear to keep it going. She was also a daughter of the American Revolution, took great pride in saying that our family could trace its roots back to the early days of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. She was convinced that we descended from someone on the Mayflower, enough that she coerced the guides at Plymouth when we visited to allow me to go over the bars and go down and stand where my ancestors had stood on the mother rock at Plymouth Rock. And so I have stood on Plymouth Rock. However, I have no ancestors from the Mayflower. My ancestors were more of the entrepreneurial sort. Both my mother and father's family descends from brothers who joined the company that landed at Newbury, Massachusetts, with Dutch cattle and sheep to provision the burgeoning Massachusetts Bay Colony and make a few dollars. For those of you who know my research interests in Frank Knight, Frank Knight's ancestors were on the same ship that my ancestors were on, landing at Newbury, Massachusetts, a fact that I only discovered after 30 years of studying him about 6 months ago. So this is my grandmother that I'm telling you about. She ensured continually my sense of American identity. I say all this to set the stage for her comment to me when we arrived at her house outside Boston in Saugus, on our way to live in Canada. Her comment in the evening after we had had dinner was short but telling. "You are a loyalist." For those of you who don't know what a loyalist is, I'll say a little bit about that in a minute. Once I was in Canada, I faced a different kind of question about identity. My friends in British Columbia kept asking me what my family heritage was. My response became sort of more and more strident or short. I just said, "I'm an American." "Yeah," they'd say, "oh, that's what kind of American? Are you Swedish? Are you Scottish? Are you Irish?" Finally, when talking about family heritage with a couple of my friends, I pointed out that my grandmother, the same one who called me a loyalist, was the keeper of the family's genealogy, and she only took each line of the family back to the point at which someone landed in North America. I said to my friends, "It doesn't matter where you come from, it matters what you do here." They replied, "Well, how do you know what you can do here if you don't know who you are?" I said, "I know who I am. I'm an American." I would hear them mutter under their breath, "That's so American." The other thing I noticed was that if I asked them to identify what it meant to be Canadian, their response would always contrast a feature of being Canadian with a feature of being American. Canadians aren't as pushy as Americans. I can never say that sentence without thinking about, now I've forgotten the name of the movie, but one of Michael Moore's, ironically, movies, the one about being Canadian. Canadians aren't as forward as Americans. Canadians are less entrepreneurial than Americans. That's one I heard very, very frequently. Of course, there's also the other side. Canadians are more caring than Americans are. Canadians are a gentle people. These comments and my discussion with people about this led to a recommendation to me after I had moved to Manitoba to work on my PhD in the mid-1980s. I was involved in the Canada-U.S. free trade discussions in Canada. I spent a lot of time telling groups what the agreement would just be about, because so many of them didn't even understand sort of what was being proposed. And I also was articulating a defense of free trade and the expansion that trade would provide for Canada and for the United States. In discussions of Canada's past economic ideas, I kept being referred to arguments about economic nationalism and Canada's sort of, especially the conservative arguments in favor of economic nationalism. And in that context, a couple people recommended to me that I read George Grant's little book, Lament for a Nation, written in 1963 after the defeat of Diefenbaker as Prime Minister of Canada, and the reemergence from Grant's point of view of a continentalist perspective, one about Canada participating in U.S. Defense of North America. Diefenbaker had wanted to not allow nuclear weapons on Canadian soil, had wanted to not be involved in any of the nuclear defense of North America in the 50s, and then also did not want free trade agreements with the U.S., et cetera. And Grant argues that the defeat of Diefenbaker marks the end of Canada as a nation. He says, from this point, Canada will not be a nation. It's inevitable that there will be a continental slide into the American empire. When you explore George Grant said, however, you know, my initial reaction was, this guy's a crotchety old man. He was who has all kinds of mixed ideas. I mean, what other country in the world could you be a progressive conservative in? Or, for that matter, what George Grant was, a red Tory, a socialist, right, monarchist. So, George Grant used to go around with NDP stickers on his car alongside anti-abortion stickers. So his conservatism and his sort of economic nationalism in defense of arguments about economy that you and I would not share. But when you examine his argument, the book, deeply, it's a critical reflection on exactly the themes of this conference. And for Grant, it goes back to my grandmother's comment about me becoming a loyalist. Grant says, the only reason that loyalists would have left America and gone to Britain because of their support of the crown, and eventually when the crown lost in the American Revolution, they were driven out. But the only reason that they would have gone to Canada and not stayed in the U.S. was if there was some part of British conservatism, because he says all of the loyalists accepted, or many of the loyalists, accepted this republic of virtue that Bill Allen told us about. They accepted that, but they didn't believe it was the whole story. So Grant says the only reason they would have left, if there was something in British conservatism that was not present, and I'm quoting from him here, not present in the bourgeois thought of Hamilton and Madison. He says, if there was nothing missing from British conservatism as it was translated by Madison and Hamilton, then the loyalists shouldn't have been loyalists. They should have just stayed in the U.S., because than the American experiment, as we have said up to this point, would be the place to be, would be the right place to be. But the Loyalists believed that there was something missing from that experiment, something that they couldn't find inside the context of the American Republican experiment, something that they needed to go to Canada to have the freedom to be able to operate in. He says, if the answer is there's nothing that separates us from the Americans, then at the core of the Canadian national character is an empty set. Nothing. And hence, Canada should die. Grant goes on to point out, and this is a theme that we've talked about frequently, Grant goes on to point out that there is something more that has survived in the U.S. He calls it the vestiges of the Judeo-Christian patrimony that has given some sense of the eternal to many people. But prescient to Sam Gregg's comment, he adds that the traditions that draw upon that heritage have become, even in his day, the 1960s, residual of the economic and political forces of what I would call, and we've called several times here, progressive liberalism in the U.S. and also in Canada. He then pronounces his verdict. Conservatism in Canada has proven unable to find that extra something in the British tradition that would justify Canada. And so conservatism is an impossibility in Canada. All Canada can be is progressive liberalism. And then he concludes, the impossibility of conservatism in our era is the impossibility of Canada. Now, he says, as a political entity and an economic entity, Canada may well survive. It may survive for quite a while. I don't think he imagines that it would have survived as long as it has. But he says the idea of Canada has died. With those reflections on Grant in mind, I turn to thinking about Canada and the United States today. Canada is less racially divisive than the United States. It's also much more multicultural. It continues to welcome a broader spectrum of people as immigrants. Canada, as a percentage of its population, accepts every year twice the percentage of legal immigrants that the United States does. That number, I can't even tell you. I won't speculate about illegal immigration. But in legal immigration, Canada accepts twice the percentage of its population that the United States accepts. And it's also, has always been, but continues to be, partly because of the Canada-U.S. Free Trade Agreement, more globally integrated through its markets. At one point in time when I lived in Canada, it was the country with the highest percentage of its economy, which was either brought in or sent out through imports and exports. Something like 60% of economic activity in Canada was directed to external markets, still very high today as well. So thinking about that, coupled with that, during the 80s and 90s, during the period when Brian Mulroney was Prime Minister of Canada and Thatcher in Britain and Reagan in the United States, the economic infrastructure changes made, the policy changes, the tax policy changes, and from my point of view, very important to mention, the expansion of its entrepreneurial base. Canada today is a very entrepreneurial country. My son lives in Vancouver. He works for startup firms. I was talking to him one day, and he said, "Oh, Dad, the firm I was just working for last week, they lost their contract, so I'm out of work." I said, "Well, you know, okay, how long is it going to take you? You know, how you doing with it?" And he said, "Oh," he said, "Dad, look, if I turned around and yelled, 'I'm a UX guy, anybody need help?'" He said, I was standing on Robson Street in Vancouver. If I yelled that, I'd have five people come running up to me and offer me jobs right now. It's like, I don't have any trouble finding work. And that's true. He hasn't had any trouble at all in the Silicon Valley of Canada, the Vancouver area. That kind of entrepreneurial expansion was largely fueled by the very economic integration that George Grant decried. Right? So I'm not here to praise Grant, but to reflect on his reflection. But in that context, it seems to me hardly surprising that Canada now slightly outranks the United States on economic freedom reports. Canada's in the top 10, the United States is 16th. And my former home, Alberta, is the most economically free part of North America. Quite rightly, it ranks 30 spots above my current home, Michigan. And yet, I think Grant may well have been right. Canada may be free, it may be economically vibrant, but does it have a soul? What is it to be Canadian? Is it the same as it was before? Is there something that can be recovered that was there before? If Grant is right, Canada actually has nothing to recover. And hence, only can move forward with the progressive liberal vision of which it has its constitution. Canada's a host of contradictions, right? It follows a constitution which has never been ratified by all the provinces of the country, but which everyone is willing to live by. But every province has the right to exempt itself from any provision of the constitution that doesn't want to obey, which is how Quebec gets away with the language laws. It's a country that can't even call a constitutional convention because there's no willing way to call such an agreement because of the multitude of voices that would seek a place at the platform and seek a share of the pie. And so it's better to just muddle along in good British fashion than to actually try to do something about it. And yet, you know, everybody's making money, so everybody's happy. Of course, the current movements that are challenging this and in a sense are seeking a return to some kind of vision are all progressive voices. The Occupy movement, Alberta now, after 51 years of conservative government, now has a NDP government. The Montreal student protests about increases in tuition. By the way, nobody protests like Montreal students protest. Okay. You know, both the U.S. and Canada may see radically different political landscapes in the next 16 to 18 months, right? So you know, we have greater prosperity in both countries. We have great similarities between them. There's very little difference today, I argue, between Canada and the U.S. My son tells me, well, we continue to say we're not like Americans. And I'm like, but your income levels are the same. You know, I go on and on and on. And yet, I still wonder whether Canada has something that can be recovered or whether it will simply be the poster country for progressive liberalism. Thank you.